Hi, this is the Watersheds at Work podcast brought to you by Tip of the Mint Watershed Council. My name is Corey Alanese, and I'll be your host. For those of you not familiar with the Watershed Council, we are a nonprofit group in northern Michigan dedicated to protecting our pristine waters through education, research, and prevention. For anyone interested in learning more, helping, or donating, please check out our website or give us a call. In this second episode, we talk with our Associate Director, Jen Buchanan, on the history of the Watershed Council, who has 20 years of experience working with us and a lot of great information to share. We will cover her unique view on what she has seen changed in the world of watersheds, whether that is shoreline development, invasive species, or nature-based solutions with stormwater. We will also talk about how her career has evolved with some of the work she does and what people can do with the changing times. I hope you enjoy. Who are you and what do you do for the Watershed Council?
My name is Jen Buchanan and I'm the Associate Director with Tip of the Mint Watershed Council.
Perfect, thank you. And so what is the purpose of a Watershed Council?
Watershed councils are formed to protect water quality in a certain geographic area. They're non-governmental, they're non-regulatory, oftentimes they're just volunteer-based. We're fortunate to have staff and don't depend solely on volunteers, although volunteers are a critical component of our organization. But watershed councils, you know, they're all over the country and they each have kind of their own identity and purpose, but overall they're there to protect water quality.
Yeah, and do you know how we started?
We started in 1979 with basically a collaboration between the University of Michigan Biological Station and local lake associations. So the biological station at that time was doing a lot of water quality protection, monitoring, assisting lake associations, primarily in Emmett, Charlevoix, and Sheboygan counties. And they had some support through a variety of federal grants. Those grants then were no longer available. And so the Watershed Council and the lake associations who supported those efforts then decided that we need to keep this group around. And so then it began as a volunteer-based organization, solely volunteers. And over a few years, they did some fundraising to help bring on a pretty modest-sized staff to help, again, these same lake associations. And over time, it grew. People recognized the value of the work that was being done and needed and wanted it to be sustained over time, and so then we just continued to grow, and like about 1984 is when I think really it gained a lot of traction and kind of moved on, went into its next phase.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so when did we start accumulating members?
Yeah, I would say those early 80s. There was at the time an executive director, part-time and maybe even volunteer-based, can't recall. And he also was good at fundraising and started pretty small with a couple hundred members, I think. And then each year that grew. We began promoting ourselves more and having more visibility, I think, in the communities. And people recognized the value of the work. It grew.
It's quite amazing to have the community come together and work towards creating this sustainable organization. How have things changed in the last 44 years that we have been running?
Again, started as basically a volunteer-based organization, a couple part-time staff, virtually no budget to, I don't know how they functioned based on the budget that I think they had. You know, the staff grew and grew, and I've only been there not quite 20 years, but my understanding is each year the organization added on staff because, well, we expanded our service area too, so now it includes Antrim County and its watersheds. So you started recognizing the work to protect watersheds goes further than just water quality monitoring, but doing more engaging with the lake associations and the communities, doing more outreach and education, you know, just telling people about what it takes to live on a lake to protect your lake. And then restoration came into the mix, and also policy and advocacy at the local level, ordinance work, things like that, that really play a critical role in water protection.
Yeah, absolutely. And even with those restoration projects or the policies or even the issues that we could have been dealing with 44 years ago, how have you seen that change?
Well, I think the development, as people continue to recognize what a wonderful part this part of the state is, and so expansion of our developed areas, our shorelines, I think that has changed because more of the watersheds are developed. So there has to be more awareness about how to do that development responsibly, and then having local government control to help guide development so that it's done in a sustainable way. And then for us, aquatic invasive species, you know, 40-some years ago, maybe there were some, but nobody was talking about it. And so zebra mussels were really probably the first thing that really hit the radar and had such a profound ecosystem impact. You know, and since then, how many dozens more aquatic invasive species have either been introduced or basically are knocking at the door? So I think that has changed a lot. I don't believe I've seen anything in the old paper files of the Watershed Council that really was talking too much about invasive species. And I think you could also say that about stormwater. We weren't really talking about stormwater management the way we are now, that we recognize non-point source pollution has always been an issue, but recognizing that there are more nature-based solutions to control what stormwater inputs to our surface waters.
Yeah, that's great. And so with that having happened previously, what are some of the positives and negatives that you see happening now?
Things, I would say that there's a lot of recognition, I think, that individuals make a difference. And so whether you live in town or you live on a lake or a river, the things that you do can impact and have a positive impact on protecting that water resource. So in my nearly 20 years, even though it's been slow, I would say, to some extent, there is every year a greater recognition, I think, of what an individual can do. The things that concern me would be aquatic invasive species, because we've seen how some species can basically wreak just havoc on a lake if they're introduced. So I worry about the next thing that we might even be aware of or not aware of, and the preventative measures that need to be taken. And not everybody's going to wash their boat, you know, and right. That worries me a little bit.
Yeah. Have you found that there's been any plans or even agendas that help give incentives to people?
I'm a big believer in incentivizing programs and good actions. And whether it's getting some costs or expenses offset by a grant through a cost share program, or at the state level for projects that use bioengineering, it's the process for getting a permit is easier. So I think there's a lot of that out there, but it's outreach and education and continuing to just encourage people to recognize their potential impact.
Right, yeah, and if you start that at the education of kids level, then you bring that into the community, and that changes it from the foundation. And yeah, I mean, just with the amount of travel that comes up here, like you said, like it wasn't nearly a fraction of what it is now.
Yeah.
And just knowing how to stop that. Because what are some of the concerned invasive species that we are trying to prevent right now?
Well, I think we've done a really decent job with recognizing that Phragmites was, you know, basically, we didn't want to end up getting invaded to the extent that, unfortunately, parts of southern Michigan have experienced. So I've been really quite pleased to see the recognition of that potential and the control efforts at the local level. Purple loosestrife has been around for a long time, and I do think we'll never eradicate any of these species, but it's starting to become more and more of the consciousness of the community. But that's slow going. What I, you know, see an invasive plant like black swallow or Japanese knotweed, I know that I'm probably only one in 50 that knows what I'm looking at. Mm-hmm. And so I guess part of that is just people being able to understand the potential impacts of aquatic invasive species, being able to recognize or identify some of these things, and then knowing what to do about it, which is oftentimes just let other people know, you know, resource agencies who handle and manage some of those plants. And Eurasian water milfoil, too, of course, is pretty common in our water bodies now, but if left undetected and untreated, that could have really significant impacts.
Yeah. What type of impacts would that be?
part of the thing with that plan is that just a fragment of a plant can propagate basically another plant and another plant and another plant. Mm-hmm. So with boating and props and things like that, it can just be exponential, basically, the impact and the number of plants that can grow from that. So that species just basically outcompetes native plants that have more habitat value and can shade out or just basically make things so congested that there's no opportunity for fish and other aquatic organisms to benefit. And then when it dies, and then it's gross, and so there's an aesthetic issue as well. But that's what invasive plants do. No fault of their own, I guess, but they are going to take any opportunity they can find to spread.
Yeah, and with, I mean, so on the environmental side, you know, takes away the fishing, takes away a lot of the environmental stuff, and then for the recreational side, then can't use your boat, you wouldn't want to go tubing in a place like that. So in both aspects, I can see that being a problem for the ecosystem and the homeowners.
Yeah.
And so what, do you have any suggestions on references for homeowners on where they can go if they find these certain species like purple loosestrife or Japanese knotweed or Eurasian water milfoil?
The Michigan Department of Natural Resources has some pretty good fact sheets basically on some of those plants. And so what I like about some of those are that, you know, it walks the person through how to properly identify it and preventative measures to keep it from spreading and then treatment. So just having some instructions on how to manage infestation given its size and the timing of treatment, all those things that are pretty critical in actual having successful management. So yeah, the Michigan Department of Natural Resources and the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes and Energy, they've got some great videos and other resources through their website that I think are not too technical, not too long-winded.
It's helpful and simple to get the point across.
Yes.
Absolutely. And so how did you get involved with, you know, invasive species, or how did you get to where you are now? What made you passionate about it?
Well, my undergrad is in natural resources, so I knew I wanted to be in the field of natural resource management in some way or another. And then I went to school for a graduate degree in landscape architecture, and that's a lot about protecting resources through proper management and not overly manipulating the environment. And restoration, whether it's taking a brownfield and figuring out a way to bring it back and make it safe and user-friendly, that was something that I was just drawn to, is basically trying to recover natural resources for the health of the environment and enjoyment of people.
Yeah. So how does that translate from what you've taken that to the work that you're doing now and the work that you've done?
Well, I think one of the big things with my time at the Watershed Council has been shoreline restoration. And so a predecessor of mine really was key in developing techniques, design protocol for restoring accelerated erosion on large high-energy lakes. And so that kind of went hand in hand, I think, with my educational background. And so I continued to grow that aspect of the Watershed Council with bioengineering. And so that's basically trying to recreate for shorelines natural conditions. So making shorelines resilient by using a lot of plant materials, the way nature basically designed a shoreline. That doesn't mean a shoreline isn't going to erode if you use those techniques, but it's all about curbing accelerated erosion. So coir logs, and then because we have such large inland lakes up here that are considered high energy, my predecessor basically incorporated formulas based on U.S. Army Corps of Engineers information to incorporate field stone to add additional armoring and protection from ice and waves, but it's always about the plants.
Yeah, stabilizing the ground. Has there been much change from when you first started doing that to now?
When I first started, the Watershed Council actually had a seasonal crew who went around installing bioengineering projects. The staff person was basically full-time, and they met with property owners and applied to develop designs and apply for permits and hired a crew and ordered materials and installed projects. It was effective and good, and we had a nice run, I think. We realized maybe we needed to focus more on making sure that existing contractors could be trained to do that work and not rely on us. And it was kind of a burden on our resources because we are not a for-profit, and so it wasn't profitable or sustainable financially. So kind of adjusting our focus on more education and training for contractors and homeowners, more for do-it-yourselfers.
Yeah, and so how can lake homeowners get involved with that? How can they learn how to do it?
Well, one of the things that I'm maybe most proud of is our involvement with the Michigan Natural Shoreland Partnership, and more specifically the Michigan Shoreland Stewards Program. So that is intended for property owners to basically do a self-assessment of their shoreline and their shoreline properties as a whole to see what they're doing as far as their degree of stewardship. It's not meant to be punitive or judgmental or anything like that. It's meant to incentivize and inspire and inform so that property owners could, you know, if they're not doing X, then they are like, oh, I didn't realize. Maybe I shouldn't have my fire ring immediately adjacent to the shoreline. I'm gonna move that fire ring back. Simple things like that. So as far as a resource for property owners, I think that is a fantastic first step, is to just check out the Michigan Shoreland Stewards website and take that self-assessment. And there are a lot of tools and information embedded in that that I think people can learn more about. And the Michigan Natural Shoreline Partnership as a whole, they do contractor trainings for shoreline contractors, and they have a lot of good resources online too. And call the Watershed Council.
Yeah, lots of information we can help people out with. And so besides that, you have experience then with what else in your field besides just bioengineering?
I've done a lot of watershed management plan writing, coordinating watershed advisory committees, grant writing, and then the other thing would be the green stormwater infrastructure or nature-based solutions. So rain gardens, bioswales, permeable pavers, all the things that are designed in the environment to help mitigate stormwater runoff. So that goes hand in hand with landscape architecture.
Right. What are the steps that we're taking to implement that or in different cities?
Yeah, we've had the benefit of having some support through local community foundations and also the state, the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes and Energy, to develop some conceptual or green stormwater visioning. And that happened in the Lake Charlevoix watershed a couple years back. And we did a lot of education, webinar, public engagement through an online survey. And we recently did a very similar thing here in Petoskey to get public feedback about, would you want a rain garden here? Because it's an expense, basically, that the city would have to do over time for maintenance, but also just making sure people understand the connection that that rain garden will look pretty and will help protect the bay. I've got some grants out there right now. I'm waiting to hear back, basically, to get some funding to then actually install some of these projects. And I have had a number of grants in the last 10 years to install some green stormwater infrastructure, mostly here in Little Traverse Bay watershed. And we have some really nice examples in town now. And I think a good example goes a long way.
Yeah. What is one of the examples in town?
Well, the one that is most visible, perhaps, would be the rain garden on the Petoskey Greenway near the St. Francis Credit Union. And the person who maintains it does a fantastic job. It's full of beautiful, colorful flowers, and people are drawn to that. And then there's signage, too. So I think that one is the most visible and very showy.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. Which is nice to have all those examples for education purposes, yeah. And the fact that it does really brighten up the sidewalks that are everywhere, and I mean, you're adding so much color, you're adding environment, And what is it that it's filtering out?
So there's an adjoining parking lot that we basically identified the low area where it was draining into what was at that point more concrete. And so that concrete was removed. So there's a new basically little sluice there. So it's collecting salt and sediment and nutrients and things like that that are tracked in on cars or even just nearby landscaping practices. So removing the whole suite of non-point source pollution.
Gotcha. And what can that do in the benefits or the non-benefits in the bay? Like if that stuff is to get out there, what are...
Right. So streams are always flushing sediments to lakes. That's kind of the role. But when you have accelerated erosion or sediment entering through storm sewer, that sediment can be bound with potentially even nastier contaminants, heavy metals and things like that. And so it's the things that are attached to those sediments, when those are suspended, you know, they increase water temperatures and they will smother nearby coastal wetlands and spawning areas. So we call our lakes are phosphorus limited, right? And so that means basically a little bit of phosphorus could potentially go a long way. And so even though there's been a lot of regulations in the last decade or more about restricting the use of phosphorus in fertilizers, they still make their way to the bay, and that can promote unwanted plant growth and decrease oxygen in the water. And the thing is, a little here, a little there adds up.
Yeah. Do you have hopes in where you see this field going, like an ideal situation? Or what is the goal you have in mind when it comes to bioengineering or rain gardens?
Well, I think we're at a point where some of these practices are becoming more familiar, more people are more comfortable, a little more commonplace. So it would be nice, ultimately, that if bioengineering on our large inland lakes was the norm and not the exception, and that our municipalities and more developed areas required or strongly encouraged green stormwater infrastructure. So again, making the norm the expectation and not just a demonstration here or demonstration there. So
right.
I think that just takes time. You know, how many ever decades ago, what did people do with their trash? They just hauled it into the back and buried it. I mean, people typically don't do that now. So it's slower going, but I hope to see that. And also, I'm encouraged by some of the technology that is emerging to control invasive species, to remove or restrict pollutants from entering waterways, whether it's through stormwater or just regular runoff. So I think we're going to see a lot of advancements in that.
Yeah. Is there any technologies that are currently out right now or that are in the up and coming that will help those situations?
You know, I think as far as like the microplastics and things like that, the inserts that are becoming more available in stormwater outfalls and the devices that can go around and gobble up micro and macro plastics, things are out there and in the works, but I just haven't studied that quite.
Yeah, definitely. That's great. It is nice. As we're evolving, we have the technology that can help us out.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to add on what level of awareness you have hopes for people to have?
I think the thing for me is, what can you do to educate yourself so that you're better stewards of this awesome area that we live in? And nothing is too small. And so even if it's picking up a candy wrapper on the side of the street that is otherwise going to flush into the storm sewer and out into the bay, because there's no real opportunity to collect trash between here and there. And so little things like that go a long way in what you do at your home. And then being aware of and supporting the organizations in your area and at the state and federal level that are doing what we can to protect water resources and natural resources in general. So it takes a lot of hands to do this important work, and those hands need support, financial support, and support the local level through regulations and ordinances. So basically just be aware of what's in your area, be aware of what you can do, and be aware of what other groups and agencies are doing to all contribute to the protection of the water resources.
Yeah. How would you find groups like that? Or where would you look or suggest for people to look, even if it's in this particular area or another area? Where would you start?
So locally, a lot of our lakes and streams have either friends of groups or lake associations. And on our website, we've got some partners listed, like Little Traverse Conservancy and Huron Pines and Conservation Resource Alliance and other groups that are doing similar work and that we partner with regularly. Those are a little more regional, and there are watershed councils throughout the state. Not every area has the benefit of having a watershed council, but if you're in southeast, southwest Michigan, you've got a watershed council down there to help. And so it would just be good to familiarize yourself with the people doing this kind of work.
And so how can people volunteer? How can they get involved personally with doing this type of work?
Well, the watershed council, you know, we're always looking to improve and expand our volunteer options because we do get a lot of requests for that. And, you know, whether it's a one day or a couple hour kind of event, like our Clean Waters Challenge, you know, which happens in the summer, and, you know, basically individuals can go out and do a stream or shoreline cleanup. And so there's simple things, short-term things like that. But then we also have our volunteer stream monitoring and volunteer lake monitoring programs that have been around for decades. And so if you live on a lake, but you don't have to live on a lake, and you want to go out every week or every other week on the same lake and collect a water sample and bring those samples into us, you know, that's a great way. We've got long-term data sets, so you'd be contributing to that. The stream monitors, there are teams that go out in May and September to the local stream, and we've got, I forget how many people, 100 people or so that are stream monitors, and collect macroinvertebrates and water temperature, and it's a lot of fun. And that's, again, another data set that we can have, because by collecting that data, you can look at long-term health trends of that water body.
That's all great information, and thank you for taking time to share all your knowledge on the podcast today, Jen. We really appreciate it. Thanks for joining us for the Watersheds at Work podcast. Be sure to check out our next episode on April 6th, where we will dive into watershed management plans with Lauren Dye and their effect on local communities and lakes. This will give us a closer look into the steps it takes to help implement change in a watershed and how to connect what a community needs into what will be done. If you're interested in more of our content, check out our icebreakers. On April 5th, we will be featuring guest speaker Danielle Zielinski, principal engineer and scientist with Great Lakes Fishery Commission, to discuss ongoing efforts to restore connectivity for stream health, biodiversity, and water quality protection, including fish pass on the Boardman River. We will also be featuring our Earth Day Bingo event starting April 1st until April 19th, where you will be able to win prizes by filling out squares with ways to help your environment. Check it out and join the fun. To register or get more info for either of these, go to the events tab on our website. And if you're looking for more ways to get involved with us, check out our social media pages, become a volunteer, or make a donation to help keep our waters clean. If you ever have any questions, please feel free to send us an email at info@watershedcouncil.org.